You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been 10 years since the American Institute of Architects published a guide to New York City buildings, and what a decade it's been. The World Trade Center no longer dominates the lower Manhattan skyline. There's been a real estate boom and an economic bust, but the fifth edition of the AIA guide puts the last 10 years into the context of a city that has seen many architectural gains and as many losses throughout its history. Before there were boroughs and neighborhoods, there were villages, and that history is evident if you know where and how to look. Fran Leeden has taken over as author of the latest AIA guide, sharing credit with its creators, Norval White and Elliot Walensky. Mr. Leeden's students at the City College of New York also contributed to this new edition of the guide, which is published by Oxford University Press. I'm very pleased that it brings Fran Leeden to our show today. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay. So this comes out every 10 years?
That's right, every 10 years. There was a 12-year gap between the third edition and the fourth edition.
As soon as someone picks up this hefty guide, the first instinct is to look for your own neighborhood or where you work. But there really is so much in it, it's easy to be sidetracked. Has it always been filled with so much information?
It has been from the first edition in 1968, and it's gotten bigger over the years. And one of the problems we had was that the binding was constrained. And so we wanted to add everything, but we couldn't. And so we had to start cutting. But until now, it's been kind of just an accumulation of facts. And there's an enormous amount of trivia and anecdotes in it besides buildings.
So I'm assuming that a fair amount of it is stuff that was in the earlier editions. But things do change. Buildings change. Facades change. Mm-hmm. How much of this is going back and looking over every entry that is already there and then, of course, considering all the new entries?
Well, that's one of the most important aspects of the guide is that it's the research is always from street level. It's never been White and Walensky both insisted on actually being there. And so when I worked with Norval White on this edition, he said, you have to make a list and go and visit every single building in the fourth edition, make sure it's still there, make sure if we said it was painted white, it's not painted yellow now. If we said there was a dry cleaner in the bottom floor, you have to make sure it's still there. So I visited every single building and then some.
And how much has changed? I used to live in Chinatown, and I always used to joke that if I went away for 2 weeks vacation, when it came back, half the stores that were across the street were no longer there.
That's right. I started working on it in 2008, that summer. And one of the problems I had was it was a never-ending loop because I was satisfied with the changes. I'd visited things. Then I realized that the book is about to come out and something's changed in a neighborhood that I checked out 2 years ago. And it's astonishing how much the city has changed in the last 10 years.
And this is the usual question. What are the criteria for inclusion? Because there are lots of interesting buildings, some of which don't make it.
That's right. And every day I walk around and I see a building that didn't make it, that we either didn't have room for or I forgot about or didn't know about. And I asked Norval about that. What is the criteria? What should I be looking for? And he came over for a visit and we drove around the city and I would point out a building and he would say, no, not good enough. And then around the corner, I'd say, well, what about that one? And he'd say, no, not bad enough. So it was either something had to be extremely good or extremely bad and not in between.
And New York has a lot of both. You say there were also 2,000 new photographs in this edition. How many photographs in all in the book?
Every single photograph is new in this edition.
Oh.
So about 2,000.
Mm-hmm. So if you decide to do something, you just had to go out and photograph everything.
That's right.
Some of the detail photographs are really a tease, especially for people familiar with the buildings. Are you hoping this tactic will get people out on the trail searching for the buildings themselves?
I hope so. I think the photographs in the previous editions were problematic because they were so small. And so we decided to make the photographs as big as we could. There's still a lot of small ones, of course, but we also decided to shoot a lot of details. And with the idea that a small photograph of a detail is better than a large photograph that you can't tell what it is.
So how much has changed? A lot of architects who didn't have representation in New York suddenly do.
Definitely.
Renzo Piano, Norman Foster, Frank Gehry. We have a proposed building by Santiago Calatrava. Mm-hmm. It seems only Zaha Hadid is not included in the list of all the big celebrity architects.
And there's another really great modern architect named Ben Van Berkel, who has had several buildings started but not finished. And so he still has nothing built in New York.
Are these the best versions of buildings by these famous architects?
I'm not sure if they're the best. There's certainly a lot of great buildings that were built by the star architects in the last 10 years. And there's a lot of things that were copies of the best buildings built by the star architects that are everywhere, especially as you get further out in the boroughs.
For years, people used to blame Mies van der Rohe for all the bad architecture that we were seeing, and it wasn't his fault. He gave us the Segra building, a masterpiece, but so many other people did the worst kinds of knockoffs.
That's right. I found that over and over again. I think the buildings that started this particular burst of building were the Richard Meier towers over by the Hudson River in the Village on Perry Street. And those were fantastic and very unusual. I think those were built in 2003. And then you walk around that neighborhood and there are direct copies of the Meier buildings almost next door. And they expanded from there, and you go out to Staten Island, and there's a very kind of low-budget version of the Richard Meier Tower out there, too. And so that's too bad, I think.
I've spoken to a number of the top architects about why they aren't as represented here as they may be in Chicago or some other cities. And the answer is that it's difficult to design buildings that will satisfy all the laws in New York City. Is that a problem?
Definitely. The permitting process in New York is very complicated, and there are people here who make careers out of just dealing with the building department. So it's a labyrinth to get something built here. So I think that's probably why. And also there's the physical constraints of the city. A lot of these sites are very difficult to build in, especially in Manhattan.
Why is that?
They're just so small. So the sliver building was a type of building that was outlawed for a while and then is come back, and there's a lot of sliver buildings that have gone up in the last 10 years.
For a while, we were seeing a lot of postmodern buildings. Is that a trend that has died?
It seems like it's died. The trend now is neo-modernism the last 10 years, and I think Meier, again, really deserves a lot of credit, or blame if you prefer, for getting that started again. It seems like there's a kind of modern revival going on. Definitely, especially with a lot of the condominiums that have gone up.
My guest is Fran Leeden, who is the lead writer in the current edition of the AIA Guide to New York City, published by Oxford University Press. Well, you aren't neutral on the questions of buildings old and new. Has attitude always been a part of the guide?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons I wanted to do it. I think a 1,000-page book about buildings in New York would get pretty dry unless you made it personal. So this has always been a very personal, almost like a diary of the city. The first editions, they were walking around, and you can feel that in the writing. It has a very breezy, very immediate tone, and I tried to bring that back.
And was banal a big word in the earlier editions? Because it's all over here.
In fact,
you even have a number of subcategories of banal.
Uh-huh. That was one of Norval's favorite words, and he liked that one. He liked stolid, which he used probably a bit too much. He also describes a lot of buildings as piles, a stayed brick pile. So that's definitely Norval's language.
Well, a lot of banal architecture is in the new housing that's being built in the hot neighborhoods of the various boroughs. I'm not sure the Bronx, but Brooklyn, Williamsburg, Greenpoint, Park Slope, some incredibly ugly buildings. Mm-hmm. There have been some, as you point out, some incredibly ugly ones along the west side and the east side of Manhattan. Long Island City has seen its fair share, Staten Island. Why is that? Is it? It seems to me if you're going to build a new building, you have an option. You can either build something that will be lovely or something that won't be. I can't imagine there's all that much difference in cost.
I'm not sure. I think a lot of the buildings you're talking about, I think it is a issue of cost, and I can tell that they're built very cheaply.
And people aren't moving into them.
For a while, and then I think it did reach the point where the city was getting, especially some of those neighborhoods you mentioned, are just getting overbuilt. And it was just supply and demand, and I think a lot of those buildings, especially in places like Williamsburg, I sort of think of them as a three-dimensional futures market. I would, in order to visit the buildings, I would go to open houses so that they would take me through them, and I could snap photos. And the agents who would be taking me through would openly be talking about it as an investment. That very little of the language was here. You know, here's where your kids can play, or here's where you can look at the view. It was.
And there are great supermarkets nearby.
It wasn't, especially not about the exterior and the street and the neighborhood at all. It was mostly about how the unit functioned and how much I could flip it for. I think it's really dollars and cents and nothing else.
Prestigious architects, Richard Meyer, designed a building for Grand Army Plaza that, as far as I know, has still not been filled, and it's been open for years now. Mm-hmm.
And it's transparent, which is unfortunate because you can see right through it and see that people aren't living there.
Well, how many of the new buildings are glass? It seems like glass for a while was on the outs, and now it's made a major comeback.
Glass has gone down in cost over the last 10 years. That's one of the reasons. They've made a lot of technological advances in the amount of heat that goes through the windows. A lot of the glass in these new buildings is fritted glass, and it has these little ceramic dots between the layers so that it regulates the solar gain. So it's they're better able to use glass, and also glass became the main image of the last 10 years during the boom and a selling point.
We have a slideshow of some of the images from the book. In fact, 18 images on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for allowing us to use them. And we're going to take a little break. People can check them out during the break. We invite listener calls in case there are buildings that you have particular feelings about. Maybe we can get to a few of those as well. And, of course, I want to talk about all of the buildings that are listed in your necrologies, the list of dead or endangered buildings throughout the city, some of them shocking because I always thought that with landmarking we weren't going to have that problem anymore. My guest is Fran Leeden of City College of New York. He and his students have added to the work of Norville White and Elliot Walensky for the latest edition, the fifth edition, of the AIA Guide to New York City, published by Oxford University Press. Our number, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. We're back with Fran Leeden. We're talking about the latest edition of the AIA Guide to New York City, published by Oxford University Press, with 2,000 photographs, and takes us neighborhood by neighborhood, sometimes street by street through a neighborhood. Interesting that building that you thought was kind of interesting down the block turns out to be something more than just interesting, but actually perhaps an important historic or architectural site. Do you have to do a lot of research to find that out?
Did I have to do a lot?
The guide suddenly reveals that a certain architect built it in 1892 or that some important person lived there once. These are not things that we would normally know.
That's right. It's amazing. The guide is amazing in that way because it's, I think, the accepted history of the city is really apparent. There's certain monuments like the Chrysler Building that everyone knows about. But the nice thing about the guide is it makes you realize that every corner of the five boroughs is historic in some way.
Most people will tell you that Chicago is a great architectural city of America. Do you think that New York gets a bum rap?
I think they're on par, and I think most people understand that New York has just as many pioneering types like Chicago, as many early skyscrapers. Lewis Sullivan has a building here as well.
Which we mistreated.
Definitely.
Stripped it of all of its ornamentation for a while. Are they restoring that? That's on Bleecker Street?
I think it is on Bleecker. It's the angels in the cornice are still there, and some of the ornament around the door is still there. But that's a landmark building, but it's unique. It's Sullivan's only building in New York. I think what New York has that Chicago doesn't have is the wealth of architecture in every stretch of the five boroughs. I don't think it's as repetitive as Chicago is once you move out towards the prairie. That's my sense of it. I may be just favoring New York.
Oh, we lost the World Trade Towers. That's a major change from the last guide. Mm-hmm. Many people disliked them until they took on a new significance. Mm-hmm. And we've had a number of histories like that. We've disliked a building, and then when it was knocked down, we were upset, and what replaced it always seemed to be worse.
That's right. And White and Walensky both treated the Trade Center pretty unfavorably in previous editions. And it was always... well, my favorite two buildings in the city before September 11th. And I had a great view of them from my apartment in Brooklyn. And so I wanted to really describe them the way that I remember them. And I always thought that they were beautiful.
Well, for many of us who didn't even think they were beautiful, mm-hmm. they were so much a part of the skyline mm-hmm. that we were more conscious of them when they were missing.
That's right. That's
they
right.
were there.
That's right. And it was amazing how they... worked on so many levels, and I remember getting out of a subway downtown, and if you were lost, you just looked up and you found the Trade Center and knew where you were.
Then there are the buildings that people protested against and now are part of the fabric of the city. I'm thinking of the Lever House, for example. A friend mm-hmm. of mine told me years ago that she protested when they were knocking down the building that the Lever House replaced. And then they were talking about knocking down the Lever House. She said, I'm going to have to go there and protest that as well.
That's funny. Yeah, that happens over and over and over again. And in buildings that were really run-of-the-mill, they become precious in people's minds just because they are used to them. They become an old friend. And the Donnell Library is a great example of that, which looks like it's going to be torn down. And honestly, it's not really that great of a building. It's kind of run-of-the-mill, mid-50s, very kind of sterile library. Really doesn't have any of the warmth that the main library has. Doesn't have an incredible reading room. But people are up in arms about that, very vocal about it.
Because it was a place they went to. It had a great collection, especially of art books.
Any library in a neighborhood is going to be an anchor, and when it's torn down, people are going to be upset.
So what has landmarking done? Has it generally preserved the better of the old buildings?
I think it really has. I think it's the most critical thing that's happened, really, the last 40, 50 years is landmarking. Without landmarking, I don't think Brooklyn Heights would still be there intact, for instance.
Although there are people who will tell you that landmarking has kind of stultified Brooklyn Heights, and now it feels like a museum neighborhood, and it's the reason that it's less popular than in Brooklyn anyway, mm-hmm. than Park Slope or mm-hmm. Cobble Hill or Carroll mm-hmm. Gardens. It doesn't have new shops. It doesn't have the kinds of things that make a neighborhood vibrant.
Mm. I think that's definitely the danger. You wouldn't want a neighborhood to be like Colonial Williamsburg. I think that New York City has so much life to it anyway that I don't think it'll ever become a theme park. So I think that's the danger with landmarking, but I think the alternative is so that vision of what would happen, I think, is so dire that I think the benefits outweigh the...
Well, what happens when we do create a theme park like the South Street Seaport?
Well, that's an interesting example, because I think the attempt there was really to freeze something in time and create a time capsule of a certain era, and it didn't work. It's interesting. The city is too vibrant for that to happen. And when you go to the South Street now, it actually seems like a time capsule of the late 70s or the early 80s, unwittingly, I think.
And then they closed down the Fulton Street Fish Market, and that took a lot of the vibrancy out of the neighborhood
as well. That's one I wrote about a lot in the new edition because it wasn't really mentioned in previous editions. And I feel like that was a great loss. I understand why it had to happen, but there was nothing like going to the fish market at 4 a.m. and seeing that whole thing unfold on the city streets. It's just incredible.
A caller wants to know the difference between postmodern and neo-modern.
Well, that's a good question. Postmodern is something that happened starting in the mid-60s, and it was really trying to bring some of the things back that were lost with modernism. And the unfortunate thing about every style is that it completely takes over, and that definitely was what happened with the first wave of modernism.
We saw that with the Chippendale building, the AT&T
right.
building, now
right.
the Sony building.
Right.
That kind of looked like it was old-fashioned, but at the same time, it was way too outsized.
Right. Well, there was one of the main features of postmodernism was to bring back some humor, and so that they would bring back ornament but make it 10 times larger than you would expect. And that was really interesting in the 60s and the early 70s. By the time you got to the mid-80s, suddenly everyone was building in that style, and everything had to have a pediment or some sort of neoclassical ornament. And that style kind of took over, and the thing that happens with any styles, it starts with the big-name architects and the big sites, and then 20 years later you see it replicated in a shopping mall in Oklahoma, and that's happened with postmodernism. So postmodernism now is being built everywhere else, and in New York now it seems to have swung back to modernism. And I use the term neo-modernism because it seems like an attempt to return to the original modern movement, but it's somehow not quite as clean as the first, as the Mies van der Rohe buildings, for instance.
Well, especially when it's a Frank Gehry kind of building.
Exactly.
Which the one that we have is sedate for Frank Gehry, that building on the west side. But it still looks different than other New York City boxy buildings.
Definitely.
And just speaking to people as we drive by, half the people I know love it and the other half hate it, which perhaps is a good thing, that at least the buildings get people excited. The
Definitely.
Alternative is for them to be invisible, isn't it?
I think that's right. I think a lot of the late modernism by the mid-60s was really about massing and not a lot else. If you look at an aerial photograph of Midtown Manhattan, it's astonishing how many late 60s tall buildings went up that are really completely have no sense of detail or ornament at all.
We don't have a lot of time, but if I throw out some questions for my audience. By the way, our number here is 212-433-9692. Are there certain buildings that you have been most disappointed to lose over the last 10 years? Do you have a favorite architectural neighborhood? Some people have favorite architectural streets. I know I have a friend who regularly travels from the Upper West Side to Montgomery Place in Park Slope because he thinks it's just the most beautiful street in the city. Our number here is 212-433-9692. My guest is Fran Leeden, who is the band behind the most recent of the AIA Guides to New York City, published by Oxford University Press, the fifth edition. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There are also landscape architecture is included in the guide. Is that architecture or isn't that just gardening?
I don't think so. That was something that I really tried to feature in the new guide. Norville and Elliot didn't do that so much in previous editions, and I used to work as a landscape architect, and so that's kind of my background as well as architecture, and I felt it was important to, it's not just about including people that deserve to be included, but my sense that it's not just about a building. It's about the building and the place, so that gardens and cemeteries and parks should be part of the story as well.
So what would you cite as a good example of landscape architecture in New York City?
You mean a recent project?
Well, then the last 10 years. Would you include Battery Park City? Is Mary Miss's work there?
Definitely. That's definitely in there. And there's another beautiful little park called Teardrop Park that's just north of there in Battery Park, that's by Michael Van Valkenburg. And it's wedged in a space between four kind of forgettable new condominiums. But it's a beautiful park. It's more like less like a Robert Moses park and more like an Olmsted park.
And now we have the High Line, which has become incredibly popular. Mm-hmm. Is that another example?
Definitely. I remember the High Line when it was abandoned and it was more romantic that way. I like the new park because I feel like it's a good solution. I don't think the High Line as an abandoned object would have lasted that much longer. So I think it's a very, very good solution. I like that it's public now.
And that they have tried to keep the plants the indigenous rather than bringing in some exotic stuff and making it into a showplace.
The interesting thing about landscape architecture as opposed to buildings is that you design something and you plant it, and then to a certain extent you can't really control it. So the High Line is interesting because it's very, very meticulously designed down to every single twig. But 20 years from now, seeds will land on the High Line and plant themselves, and there's really nothing you can do about it.
Let's take a few calls. Marie from Riverdale, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I want to know what you think of the Jean Nouvel undulating glass condo on West Side Highway. And what style do you think that is? And if you think it works, that it's right across the street from the Frank Gehry undulating glass structure.
I think it works really well with the Gehry building. I think they both benefit from being next to each other. Honestly, I'm not crazy about that building. He has a much better new building on Mercer Street, which I think is a little bit more in control. I think maybe because the river was right there, he didn't have as many buildings to refer to. I think there's some really good things going on with that building, but I think it got a little out of control for my taste.
I'm curious about Jean Nouvel coming to New York. Mm-hmm. We see no Jean Nouvel for a while, although he's famous all over the world. And then suddenly we have a bunch of buildings. Do we go through architectural fads?
I think it is. It's almost like an actor has a few good roles, and then suddenly you see them in every movie. It's kind of that way with architects. One commission leads to another one. Frank Gehry had the building over on the West Side Highway, and now he has the tower on Beekman Place that's going up. He had nothing in New York before that.
There was a lot of talk about why he had nothing, but suddenly we went from zero Frank Gehrys to two and probably more in the works. Barry from Hell's Kitchen, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to say how dreadful the buildings from 9th Avenue all the way through to 11th on 42nd Street. What a disaster that was.
The Manhattan Plaza buildings.
Yeah, they could have made that so pretty, like the High Line. They could have done something incorporating the river, incorporating some kind of fun park, et cetera, et cetera. Just, you know, one monstrous high-rise after another. And I've gone to look at some of those apartments, and they're just dreadfully built, dreadful.
I agree.
Well, and they were hard to rent for a while because of that, and it wound up becoming a place where actors were allowed to live on very low rents. I know my mother lived there for quite a while. And then it became a place that everybody wanted to be because all their friends were living there. So it worked, actually, but it was subsidized. It was high-rise, fancy, luxury building that was subsidized by the federal government. Is that no longer happening?
It seems like when that does happen, it's not in the tower format anymore. I think that there were some lessons learned about that, especially for the reasons that this caller made, that what happens at the ground level. And I think there's subsidized housing is now tends to be more low scale and has more of the neighborhood feel, which is, I think, is great.
Now, that project was also designed to gentrify the area, which had been seen mm-hmm. as a rather rundown area. We've been seeing gentrification all over the city.
It's incredible, yeah. That's one of the main...
Has it been something that you see as a positive force?
I think it has a positive side, honestly, and it has a bad side. I think walking around the city, looking at some of the buildings that were described in the last edition as being abandoned or run down, you realize that now there's a market for them, so they've been restored. And I think the restoration of these old buildings is related to gentrification, and I can't fault them for that. I think the downside is that I noticed over and over again a kind of homogenization going on in neighborhoods, and there's less cultural differences. Just little things that we took for granted, like hardware stores and bodegas, are disappearing, and I think that's a shame. And that's also related to gentrification, no doubt.
We go now to Nick from the Upper West Side. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I think the reason that things like South Street Seaport and things like it don't work is because you can't kill something and then prop up its corpse and expect it to work. If you want to preserve something, preserve it and leave it alone.
But we've seen these kinds of projects all over the country. Denver has mm-hmm. its old town or whatever
Baltimore.
They call it. And they seem to be more successful than they are. Or they are here, or maybe they're not more successful. I don't know, because I don't mm-hmm. stay. I don't spend mm-hmm. much time in Baltimore or Denver or some of the Southwest cities that have those kinds of mm-hmm. areas.
I think it would have worked. I think they took the wrong approach with South Street, and I think the fact that it was right next to the Fulton Fish Market, which was so vibrant and still working, the contrast was unsettling between the vibrancy of the Fulton Fish Market and South Street right next door. And South Street is full of people on lunch hour from Wall Street and some tourists. But I've been there, especially on weekdays, when it's abandoned. There's no one around. So,
well, we have this guide, which is so much fun to use. I know that I started, as so many people do, looking at my block. And the next thing I knew, I was on another block. And mm-hmm. then I was in another area. And in the end, you come to appreciate the whole city or want to go to places mm-hmm. that you may never have visited because they're really interesting. Mm-hmm. And my great thanks to you for giving us this. Fran Leiden, who teaches at City College of New York and is the key contributor to the latest edition, the fifth edition of the AIA Guide to New York City, co-author with Norval White and Elliot Walensky. The book is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.